Welcome back to Half Past Capitalism, where we talk about alternatives to capitalism as if they were possible. This show is part of the Harbinger Media Network. And today I have a little bit of a shorter show. It's just a half-hour interview I did with Mo Manklang of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. And the USFWC has been part of a big push to get some laws changed, basically, to make conditions more favorable to co-ops. So when we talk about building a cooperative economy, generally it's sort of a bottom-up kind of effort. Obviously, it takes it's just a lot of energy and education and organizing at the sort of, you know, grassroots level to get people to understand what a co-op is, how to come together, how to organize in their collective economic and social and environmental self-interest. So that's usually what we think of when we think of cooperative organizing. But one of the cool things about what happens when you build a bunch of co-ops is that together they have the capacity, they start to have the capacity to advocate for themselves, not just at a sort of neighborhood level or community level or at the level of their membership, but at the level of municipalities or the state level or the national level, or in Canada's case, obviously the municipal, provincial, and federal levels. And that can do some really interesting things, because obviously that's where the sort of playing field is set in tax codes, how real estate is taxed, how different kinds of organizations are taxed, what kinds of subsidies are available to different kinds of businesses, what kind of economy, those governments want to see happen. And then obviously there are anything from like a small to a tremendous amount of subsidies that sort of come through those governments, mostly to big corporations with a lot of concentrated power and hire a lot of lobbyists, but not uniquely. So I wanted to get a bit of a view about what co-op advocacy, or at least one lens on what co-op advocacy looks like at the sort of federal level in the U.S. And also a little bit, we talk a little bit about the state and municipal level as well. And one thing that we didn't get to talk about is the CHIPS Act, the big legislation that the Biden administration put forward and that Congress passed recently, which is basically trying to bring chip manufacturing, so microprocessors and other kinds of computer equipment, basically bringing that back to the U.S. Instead of being so reliant on China. So one of the things we didn't get to talk about in this interview was that there's actually quite a bit of little provisions in there to include cooperatives in various ways, which is sort of just another interesting development. And obviously, these things don't really show up in the at the specific level. Like, no one's going to be like, oh, because of a change in the tax code, I'm going to start a co-op. On the other hand, they do show up in the aggregate, because I think when people who want to start co-ops do business assessments, they're just like X percent more likely to be able to say, oh, this could work. We could buy this business from the previous owner and run it as a worker co-op. Or we could, create a democratic workplace in this other scenario. So for that reason, I was really interested to hear what Mo said, and we get pretty into the nitty-gritty of sort of what the policy advocacy of the USFWC looks like, and how it's conducted, and how different cooperatives are involved. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Here's Mo Manklang.
What would you say is the signature achievement of the sort of policy advocacy within the co-op movement, just from your sort of straight up subjective experience?
Sure. I'm going to tweak that a little bit to say, because signature, I think, is, this is kind of our, exactly what we wanted and executed exactly perfectly. From really the hindsight of what I would say is probably the most significant achievement in the last several years for worker co-ops hasn't quite panned out how we wanted it to. So I'm referring to the Main Street Employee Ownership Act, which passed in 2018. And that bill was a federal bill that basically directed the Small Business Administration to promote employee ownership in all its different facets, particularly through its small business development centers. And that was a huge deal. It was the first bill in decades that really focused in on employee ownership and worker cooperatives specifically. It was a very big, significant moment. In hindsight, over the last several years, what we found is that there hasn't been much done with it because there wasn't money attached to it. There hasn't been a lot moving forward. There's a lot moving forward now. But the reason that I think it's still very significant is A, because it was the first bill in decades that really tuned into what the worker co-op movement, but also it spurred a lot more conversation about employee ownership. So I think generally we're working towards like making worker co-ops a household name in the US as it is in other countries. I think what it did do is allow us to leverage that piece of legislation, which was passed at a bipartisan level, to create other wins at state levels, at local levels, and to basically like tell our story in a way that kind of like was legitimized by this kind of like federal win, and leverage that to create more wins, which are very much in the fire right now.
Fair enough. Can you just go into a little bit about sort of what are the key things in that legislation for worker co-ops, and then some of the maybe a little bit about the process of how you got there, how you got to the point of passing that legislation.
Sure. So the major bill, the primary driver is, as I mentioned, directing the Small Business Administration to do outreach and education about worker ownership. So the way the SBA works is, there's the SBA at the federal level. They have district offices, usually like a couple per state, and then several small business development centers. That's kind of like how their chain of offices. And the idea is that the small business development centers would do outreach education, be available to provide what they already provide, so free services to help small businesses, but really make sure that they have resources available and connection to the employee ownership partners. So like people within the worker co-op space, the employee stock ownership space. So that was one piece of it. Another big piece of the bill was this report that helped to, that was meant to illustrate what are the challenges for co-ops in accessing SBA products. So, their flagship program is the SBA 7A loan program. And, that loan program requires a personal guarantee. And usually that personal guarantee is from like one person or two people from a business. But that's kind of out of sync with how worker co-ops work, because there might be three owners, there might be 300 owners. So we're going to understand those challenges that, we had been advocating for several years. So that report was created, but with no kind of like there in terms of what the SBA was going to do to shift those programs to accommodate this underserved sector of cooperatives and ESOPs. And I would say, this was the Main Street Act was a little bit of a unicorn in the sense that it passed very, very quickly. So we had been working with the office of then presidential candidate Kirsten Gillibrand to create the bill, socialize it, recruit bipartisan support for it. And I would say it was really in less than a year from the process of, we're interested in supporting worker ownership. What's one thing that we can do? And then kind of going through this process of like vetting the legislation. We basically worked with our office to go through creating the idea for the bill, sending it to legislative council, which comes up with the actual text of the bill. And then reviewing that and making sure that we're tweaking, vetting it through our communities and making sure that it actually is doing what we think it's going to do. So, you know, typically that process takes, can be anywhere from, you know, like several months to several years in the case of other bills that we've been working on. But this one actually passed quite quickly, and it actually was folded into that year's Defense Act. So, you know, if you're looking up the Mainstream Employee Ownership Act, you won't see it like on its own. You'll see it as part of the National Defense Act, which, you know, it's just kind of like one of those interesting quirks. Quirks is maybe the most generous term for, you know, like how bills make their way through Congress. So, you know, it involved a lot of very close communication with Gillibrand's office, helping to identify our members that might be able to recruit support from other legislators. So, you know, I think we had Susan Collins, Todd Young, both on the Republican side, I think Senator Booker on the Democratic side, in addition to Senator Gillibrand, and then working with Nidhi Velasquez on the House side, who is the head of the Small Business Committee. So.
And can you shed a little bit of light on how you kind of created those relationships, or who was creating the relationships with those legislators, and sort of how did that develop, and what kind of efforts did that take?
Yeah, so one thing that's really interesting about worker ownership is, you know, we've been primarily at the federal level, we've largely been reactive to people coming to us. So it's interesting, you know, when I started the Federation, you know, 5.5 or so years ago, you know, we thought, okay, this policy work needs to happen. We know it needs to happen. It's going to be a part of my position, but we don't think it's going to be quite that much. And then almost immediately we started getting asks from legislators who wanted to know more about worker ownership, who wanted to create bills in support of them. And, you know, so we actually had Senator Gillibrand's office come to us and ask our opinion, you know, as I think they had been working primarily with some of the kind of the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Plan folks, to develop the bill, but wanted to make sure that they had worker co-ops also incorporated in it. So they came to us as the National Membership Organization for Worker Co-ops to ask our opinion, to figure out who else should be in the room. So we did a lot of work to make sure that, you know, working in tandem with the Democracy at Work Institute, which is our sister organization. You know, I would say like we worked kind of as a team and created some additional relationships. You know, they had at the same time had also been reaching out to folks like the National Cooperative Bank and the National Cooperative Business Association, both of which, you know, they're already relationships on the Hill from those organizations. So it's kind of, you know, we know certain people in the co-op community, and then, you know, those people identify us, they come to us, those kind of things. So, really what we do in general is we look at where worker co-ops are and where we might identify folks who would be interested in supporting worker ownership. So it's kind of like paralleling representatives on the Hill to where there is like a confluence of worker co-ops, so we can bring those constituents to their representatives and say like, hey, we're already doing this worker co-op thing. It's already been successful. We've been around for a while. How can we make this happen more?
And I'm curious about the sort of what the sort of other opportunities are. Obviously, federally, that's the super interesting one, because it's like, yeah, you end up like working with Republicans and like leveraging the rhetoric of small business and all this stuff, and finding ways to like make that work. And it ends up in the Defense Act. So I find that all fascinating, but what does it look like at the sort of state and municipal level? Have you seen any sort of big wins there in terms of channeling resources to co-ops or promoting worker cooperation?
Yeah, for sure. You're actually coming at a very interesting time, because just in Pennsylvania, where I live, we just the kind of outside of the government, Center for Employee Ownership in Pennsylvania, has been working to introduce a bill to create a government office of employee ownership here in Pennsylvania. So that actually just happened about a week ago, about a month ago in California. So I've been working with the Worker Owned Recovery California Coalition, which is a consortium of people in the worker co-op ecosystem in California, like across the state. And we just passed the bill to create the Center for Employee Ownership, which was a huge win, dedicating, you know, we still have to go through appropriations, but the idea is that they would be appropriating about $1 billion towards creating this office, staffing it up, helping to set up what we need in order to facilitate programs to support worker co-ops and ESOPs in California. So, you know, we've seen a lot of moves towards creating those centers in different states. There's already one in Massachusetts. There's been work to create one in the in Connecticut. So there's a lot of centers for employee ownership that are not government funded, but the move, we've been seeing like a movement towards creating those within the Office of Economic Development or small business within different states. So Colorado isn't a great example that's created some pretty hefty programs to make loans and grants accessible to worker co-ops. And so we've seen a lot of success there, spurring the growth and startup of a lot of worker co-ops in that area. So that's kind of at the state level. And then at the city level, we've seen a few different municipalities working to it. So our sister organization, Tobacco State Work Institute, has been running this program called the Shared Equity and Economic Development Fellowship, where they create partnerships within different cities to promote worker co-ops. So the idea is that you're going into a city, identifying staffers who are interested in the topic, connecting them with the co-op folks on the ground that are kind of like community organizations that can anchor that work, and then just creating a structure for them to learn about worker ownership. So so that's been, you know, there were, as of now, been two different cohorts of four different cities that have participated in the program. So seeing a lot more interest in that area, just to do that initial like outreach, education, learning piece, which is really important. It's important that the educators know, the educators are educated in terms of, you know, understanding the model and things like that. The city of Santa Clara actually committed a chunk of money towards their worker co-op development initiative, and that included a series of sessions with city staffers to learn about worker ownership that was facilitated by Tobacco State Work Institute, the Sustainable Economies Law Center, us, the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops, and Project Equity. I'm worried that I forgot someone in there, but you know, it was a small group of us, and so it was a series for internal staff and also a series for business owners in the Santa Clara area who were interested in possibly selling their business or in starting a worker co-op. So that's just kind of like a little bit of a touchstone to some like many initiatives that have been happening. I know one last thing is the city of Austin has recently invested in a series of trainings also on co-op development that's primarily being run by the Austin Cooperative Business Association.
Wow, there's really a lot going on. It's great to hear.
It's a ton, hard to keep up.
For sure. And in terms of all these different initiatives, what would you say is sort of the common thread in terms of the sort of, I don't know, the advocacy or the sort of what's the animating force? Is it worker co-ops themselves? Is it nonprofits? Is it a combination? Like what's the mix in terms of what's advancing these things forward? And what would you, and it sounds like legislators are very open. So I'd be interested to hear, you know, sort of, yeah, what is creating that context that is leading to all these initiatives happening and being successful?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a bunch of different factors there. So, you know, I think in this moment, you know, we're not post COVID certainly, but we're kind of like in this different phase of COVID, right? Where people, you know, we've reoriented a little bit towards how we feel about workers, and people are searching for ways that they can more centralize the well-being and the wealth building of workers, primarily, especially frontline workers, but, you know, really like understanding what could it mean to kind of like rearrange how we think about business in the US. And And so I think we, you know, we've had a lot of people coming to us just to learn more and to make it, you know, like I was just on a call with someone who is, he is the expected winner of the city council race in DC. And he made cooperatives a part of his platform and wants to, like, you know, is preparing for his entering into that office and wants to know, like, okay, like, what specifically can we do? And, like, who are the people that we need to line up and understand? So he has people searching for different ways to support workers. You know, I think there are co-op developers in the field that are seeing, you know, they have serviced co-ops, right? And so they have identified, like, here are the pain points, here's what we need in order to create a good atmosphere for worker co-ops to not just, like, start, but really thrive and last for the long term. You know, typically worker co-ops have a better track record for longevity than a regular small businesses. But, you know, to really, like, shore that up and make sure that they can last. So a lot of the times it's co-op developers who are, like, making moves, people that are like me that are paid to do this work. And then, you know, from our perspective as the membership organization for worker co-ops, it's been a priority for us to make more opportunities for worker owners to engage in that. So we actually created a program last year that we're continuing this year called the Worker Ownership State Advocacy Fellowship. That's meant to create kind of a pipeline of worker owners who are prepared to do advocacy, who are you know, paid for their time to participate in the program, who are learning how to, you know, talk succinctly about their own business and also just generally about worker ownership, and to be able to engage and, like, really inform legislation as it becomes available, and to be able to be the people that are actually going and suggesting this to their legislators. So I think it comes from all different angles. I would say primarily it's been kind of like the people that are in the kind of nonprofit space that you know, are paid to kind of promote the idea of cooperative development, the cooperative ownership, that are kind of, like, pushing this at the local levels, but we're really, really making sure also that worker owners are present at the table to share their stories of success and their challenges, of course.
Yeah, that's great. In terms of the U.S. WCF, you have a sort of a bi-monthly meeting where you have people coming together to talk about policy advocacy and stuff and sort of sharing. I'm assuming it's to share the sort of, you know, experiences and coordinate. But can you talk a bit about that? Like, what does that process look like in terms of involving your sort of, yeah, the worker members in your member co-ops? And do you have any sort of, I don't know, insights into how you've been able to keep them engaged, or what's been something that has sort of kept the ball rolling there? Because obviously people get busy. So I'm just curious what have you found are sort of the best practices for that?
I love this question. This is my favorite question. It's the favorite part of my job as well. So our Policy and Advocacy Council, which was established in 2015, is, you know, it's one of our many member councils that represent a driving force of the membership in an area of particular interest. So policy and advocacy was an area that our worker owner members particularly said, hey, we want to focus on this and we want to expand our capabilities and our work in this area. So let's create a council where we can regularly talk about how that can happen. So it started in 2015 as a council that met once a month to just talk about, like, whatever was coming up and to make plans, figure out, like, do we need to create education materials, toolkits, things like that. I came on in 2017, and you know, we kind of continue this route of, you know, updating each other on what's going on. And then pretty soon we realized, like, there's actually too much work, that there's so much to talk about. And 1 hour a month doesn't quite seem like enough. So we actually split it into two. So our council meets on the first week and the third week of the month. And on the first week, we talk about updates. So what's going on in your neck of the woods? What can you share about what's happening in your area so that other people can learn from it and understand understand like where kind of like where different cities are stacking up against each other, or different localities. And then on the third Thursday of the month, we actually talk about these strategy questions. So we dig in deep into like, you know, what does it mean for co-ops to work in coordination with employee stock ownership plans, which is, you know, effectively talks about the worker ownership part, but not the workplace democracy part, right? So what does it mean to work in coalition with those groups? Where do we agree? Where do we, where might we not be aligned? And how do we reconcile those things? We talk about like this last time around, we talked about, you know, like how could we standardize kind of a, an interview format for worker owners to understand what their priorities are, what their challenges are, so that we can translate those into either legislative action or some sort of specific advocacy campaign, things like that. So, it kind of varies because we meet twice a month. It gives people plenty of opportunities to drop in. So any member is always welcome to drop into the conversation, hear about it. Everybody always has access to the notes so they can know kind of like what's going on, even if they're not there, to be able to access what's going on. And you know, my door is always open. So I have plenty of meetings where people are just trying to catch up and get to know what's going on. But the council is really the place where people are able to make connections and to vet their ideas. So like, yeah, if people have a policy platform that they're thinking about, sharing it with the group and getting feedback on that. These are all kind of ways that we can sharpen and hone each other's work in a way that feels iterative and also can like help us to operate more efficiently, so we're not all recreating the wheel every time.
And I guess just to wrap up, I want to sort of try to put two questions into one for efficiency's sake. But I guess to zoom on the one hand, to zoom out, I'm curious what you would say, what advice would you give to somebody who's wanting to sort of start building power around, community and worker ownership of enterprises? Like what are the sort of starting points for somebody who's just like starting out in that? What would be your advice for somebody, who's interested in I guess policy advocacy in particular, and how does that fit into that bigger theme of building power?
I think those are pretty interrelated. So if you're interested in just kind of like learning about worker ownership, I would encourage folks to check out. So the Federation has a directory online of both our membership and of worker co-ops. So you can look up, you know, what worker co-ops are in your area, who's around. We have a local partner section where people get to, if there is kind of like a local organizing body, they can get connected that way. The National Cooperative Business Association similarly has their list of membership to get to know just like who are the players in the co-op ecosystem. And if you don't know, you can always email policy at usworker.coop to learn about that. I think to the policy and advocacy side, I think it's like leveraging the relationships that you have. So, first off, the obvious, like know who your representatives are, know what their issues are. So, you know, whenever we're getting ready for meetings, we always like look at, okay, what are their policy platforms? Like, is there a piece about economics, jobs, small business, you know, and like, how do we tailor that messaging to that representative and what they're trying to accomplish? Because, you know, we're all, I think a lot of times we're all working towards the same things and just trying to speak the same language that can help to move forward policy in a way that helps everybody, right? So that's a lot of my job, is really just kind of trying to come up with a language that helps people to like access understanding of work crops, understanding of, you know, what can be like a very like heady, like government structure systems, things like that. So I think knowing who your representatives are, just having meetings with them, you know, attending their town halls. We also have a database of initiatives that have happened. So like getting to know, like, is there a state statute for your co-op? Have there been any bills that have been introduced in your state in the last couple decades? You know, so just kind of like getting a lay of the land. And then the one other thing that I would say, if you're really interested in starting a worker co-op, is the Federation runs a a webinar on the first Friday of every month. That's a worker co-op startup webinar. So you can learn what the basics are of worker co-ops. I actually think it's good even if you're not trying to start a worker co-op, you're just trying to learn. So it kind of runs you through the basics with our co-op clinic. And then there's plenty of time to ask questions. I always find it, even though like I have been to that webinar many times, I try to go whenever I can just to hear the questions that people are asking, because I think it's really telling as to like how people are understanding worker co-ops, their familiarity with them.
Great. Well, thanks so much. It'll be interesting to see how that lands in the Canadian context. But I think that there's lots of interesting lessons there for folks in any case, and for those watching in the U.S. Obviously, there's lots of great resources there. So thanks again, Mo, for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for inviting me, Drew.